This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jane Goodall, is famous around the world for her research on chimpanzees in the wild. She began her research in 1960 at the Gombe Reserve in Tanzania under the direction of Dr. Louis Leakey. Although her project at the Gombe Reserve continues, much of the work now is done by Goodall's staff of researchers, while she travels the world lecturing on behalf of the Jane Goodall Institute. Goodall's new book, Reason for Hope, is about her years in the wild and its impact on her spiritual life. A companion documentary will be shown on public television October 27th. Goodall says she's never found religion to be incompatible with her work. However, many Christians find evolution to be a concept totally incompatible with the Bible. I asked Jane Goodall how she reconciles that.
Well, as a matter of fact, if you look at a lot of the Bible, things are explained in parables. I think that Jesus of Nazareth was a great parable teller. And in fact, if you look at the story of creation in Genesis, it's amazingly close to actual evolution, if you believe in Darwinian evolution, except that instead of things happening in one day, you take a few million years. It follows terribly, terribly closely the pattern of evolving life forms.
Now, you describe in your book kind of spiritual awakening that you had at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. Would you describe that a little bit for us?
Yeah, it was quite amazing. It came at a rather disturbing time of my life when I was just going through a divorce. And I'd always wanted to go to that cathedral after reading Victor Hugo's book, The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And it was just very strange that as I walked in, the sunlight was flooding, and it was the early morning sun, flooding through the great rose window. And just like an orchestrated play, suddenly the organ sprang into life, and Bach Toccata and Fugue in G minor just filled that whole great, amazing cathedral. And it was as though I came to a point of reckoning. I mean, could all this, the amazing architecture of the cathedral, the glass, the mind of Bach when he wrote that music, all the countless people who'd worshipped in the cathedral, and my mind that was able to comprehend all this and question it in one flash, could that all be the result of chance gyrations of bits of matter? And I felt, no, there's no way. This has to be some kind of purpose behind our emergence onto the earth, our human emergence onto the earth. In other words, there was some kind of destiny we were moving towards.
Now, I found it really interesting that you had this spiritual awakening in a man-made place, in a cathedral, you know, listening to man-made music, as opposed to having this spiritual revelation in the wild, which man did not create.
Well, in the wild, I think there was a constant nurturing of my spiritual beliefs. It's just that I wasn't really conscious of them. They were part of life. Mm-hmm. And being in nature, I've always felt very close to that great spiritual presence. But it was in the cathedral, perhaps because I'd come out of the forest where things of the spirit just seem part of it all, that I was suddenly forced to question what I really believed, sort of, so that it was more of an intellectual challenge. Whereas in the forest, it's just your being that's immersed in this spirit power.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jane Goodall. Her new book is called Reason for Hope, A Spiritual Journey. I'd like to talk with you about your work in Africa studying chimpanzees. You went first to secretarial school, which isn't the perfect training for a primatologist. What were you expecting to happen by, what was your plan going to secretarial school?
Well, from the age of 8 or 9, I wanted to go to Africa, live with animals and write books about them. And that was because I fell in love with Tarzan and was terribly jealous of Tarzan's Jane. And I thought she was a wimp and I'd have been much better as a mate for Tarzan myself, which is true, I would have been. And, you know, everybody laughed at me. How could I go to Africa? We didn't have any money. It was during the Second World War. There were no jets going over with tourists. And we just heard rumors about, you know, poisoned arrows and sinister drumbeat messages and things like that. But my mother never laughed. And she used to say, Jane, if you really want something, you work hard, you take advantage of opportunity, and you never give up, you'll find a way. So I left school and didn't go to university because at that time in England, unless you were good in a foreign language, you couldn't get a scholarship. And I was always hopeless in foreign languages. And so my mother said, well, if you are set on going to Africa or some other foreign place, if you learn secretarial work, then you can get a job anywhere in the world, which, of course, was a brilliant idea because that's exactly what I did. I had my first job with Louis Leakey as his secretary.
How did you get a job as a secretary? How did you even meet him?
Well, I was in London. I had this wonderful job with documentary films, and it was...
As a secretary? Great.
Secretary, not really. I sort of was choosing music and things like that for these documentary films. Mm-hmm. And it was a fascinating job, and I met lots of people, but didn't pay very well. Lots of jobs didn't just after the war. So when I had a letter from a school friend inviting me to Kenya, where her parents had just bought a farm, I instantly handed in my resignation and went home and worked as a waitress and saved up my wages and my tips until I had enough for a return fare by boat. So once I got out to Kenya in Nairobi, I heard about Louis Leakey, and somebody said, Jane, if you are really are interested in animals, you should meet Louis. So I made an appointment, went to see him in his office at the Natural History Museum, and I think he was impressed because although I didn't have a degree, I'd gone on reading about Africa and animals and I could answer so many of his questions. So he gave me a job working for him that same day, the day I met him.
And what was your job when you were his personal secretary?
Oh, I was just writing his letters and speaking to people on the phone and, you know, that kind of thing. But I had the amazing opportunity of going with him, his wife, and one other young English girl onto the Serengeti, to the now famous Olduvai Gorge, where so many early human fossils have been found. But at that time, only the remains of prehistoric non-humans had been found. So instead of being a road leading there as there is today, this was wild, untouched Africa. No tracks, no trails, just occasionally the odd Maasai walking by, and all the animals were there, so that after the hard work of searching for bones, fossilized bones during the day in the hot sun, Gillian and I were allowed to go onto the plains, and you know, there were giraffe and zebra and antelopes, and one evening a rhino, and one evening a young male lion who followed us quite a long way. And I think that's when Louis realized I was the person he'd been looking for. You know, I didn't care about clothes and hairdressers and parties and boyfriends. I just wanted to be out there with the animals.
And so he gave you the chimp project to do, researching chimpanzees in the wild?
Right. He had two major problems to overcome. One was, how was he going to get the money for this crazy scheme? I mean, in those days, young people didn't go tramping off living with animals in the bush, especially girls. And finally, he got some money from a wealthy American businessman, Leighton Wilkie. And secondly, Tanzania, where the chimps are, was Tanganyika then. It was under British colonial rule. It was actually a protectorate. And so the authorities, the British authorities, said, a young girl on her own in the bush, preposterous, impossible. But Louis never gave up. So in the end, they said, oh, well, all right, but she must bring someone with her. And who volunteered to come for the first 4 months but that same amazing mother?
So did the British government feel any better about two women alone in the wild?
Yeah, they did. They felt that you know, I would have some support and I wouldn't be completely isolated.
Did you think of Leakey as an early feminist in a way, because he thought it was fine to have you, a young woman, heading this project and working alone in the wild?
Quite honestly, it never occurred to me. I mean, I grew up in a family of very strong women. There was, you know, when the war started, my father joined up. Mum, my sister, and I went to live with her mother. And my mother had two other sisters living in the house. And then every weekend, or most weekends, my uncle would come. He was the one male presence. And it just never occurred to me to question that I would be able to do what I wanted. It didn't, you know, it just didn't enter my thinking that I couldn't do some things because I was a woman. So when Leakey suggested I went out, we didn't actually talk about it much as being strange that I was a female. And it wasn't until the British authorities started saying they were horrified that I realised it was perhaps a little strange at the time. But he just felt that women would be more patient and therefore make better observers.
Did it change your relationship with your mother to be alone together in the forest?
No, not really. We'd always had a super relationship and, you know, she was amazing. She set up a little clinic for the local fishermen with medicines from her brother, who was a doctor, and simple aspirins, Band-Aids, Epsom salts, that kind of thing. And so she established a wonderful relationship with the fishermen, which, of course, stood me and my students who followed in such good stead ever after.
And it also gave her work to do.
It gave her something to do, and she spent so long on each patient that she made some amazing cures, because they hated going to hospital. They felt you went to hospital to die. So she got some pretty sick people. And in fact, I subsequently discovered that she was known as a white witch doctor.
My guest is Jane Goodall. Her new book is called Reason for Hope. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jane Goodall, who is known around the world for her research on chimpanzees in the wild. Her new book is called Reason for Hope, A Spiritual Journey. Now, you write that when you first started doing work in the wild, you weren't afraid of being harmed by wild animals. You believed that the animals would sense that you intended no harm, that you were there as a friend, and that Leakey encouraged you to believe this. Do you think he should have discouraged you to believe this and given you a little more cause for concern?
Well, no, because at the same time, he taught me that I had to be very careful, mm-hmm. and that animals were dangerous, or could be, and that, for example, if you got between a mother and her young, you'd be in big, big trouble. If you startled an animal, you'd be in big trouble, and that you might come across some creature who'd been wounded and who hated people. So I was perfectly aware of possible danger and tried to be as careful as I could, and he spent quite a lot of time teaching me, so that he didn't tell me not to be afraid. And I think there are moments when fear is terribly important. You know, if you suddenly hear stamping or snorting close by in the undergrowth, it's better to have some kind of mechanism to deal with it, like climbing a tree, which I once did just in time not to be charged by two buffaloes.
Did you already know how to climb a tree quickly?
I think when in situations like that, you probably learn fast. But in fact, all my childhood, I'd loved climbing trees. And I had one special tree in the garden, which I actually made my grandmother write out like a sort of will, leaving it to me when she died. I would take my homework up there and I'd just go and sit up there if I was either happy or sad. And as we still have the same house, you know, beach is still there, and I still love beach.
Well, you just described a close call. Were you ever harmed?
No, I never was actually harmed until quite recently. We have one chimp who's a bully, Fifi's son, Frodo, and he just loves, he's not trying to actually really hurt or kill anyone, but because the ground is so rugged and rocky, if he knocks you over and drags you and stamps on you, you can get a little bit hurt. And I did.
What did he do to you?
Well, he knocked me over, and then he stamped on me, and then he charged away, and then, which he does to lots of people, but for some reason he charged back twice more and stamped and dragged and sort of cracked open, well, not cracked open my head, but I had a bleeding cut where he'd hit my head on a rock and a damaged ankle. So I tried to avoid Frodo. You know, he is potentially dangerous. He's 130 pounds, the biggest chimp we've had there. He's the top-ranking male now, and he is huge.
Well, you know, if it's a person, you could try to work things out verbally, even after, to reach some kind of verbal apology or agreement, which you can't do with the chimpanzee. Are you, you know, angry with him the way you would be with a person, or do you feel like, well, it's chimp behavior and you're there to observe it and you just accept this?
Well, theoretically, I think it's just chimp behavior, I must accept it. But actually, you know, chimps are so like people, I actually get pretty mad at him. It's just, you can't help it. You feel you're dealing with a whole lot of people, actually. So, well, yeah, I get mad at him and I try to avoid him.
Has this incident changed your behavior around the chimps or how close you'll go to them? Or is it just changing your behavior around this one chimp?
Yeah, it's just the one. I mean, the others are just the same wonderful chimps. They always have been. Mm-hmm. And I think if I was there all the time, this problem would go away. I think it's because I disappear for so long. And there is something in the chimp's makeup that even if it's another chimp, a long separation is likely to lead to aggression when the two chimps meet again.
Mm-hmm. Now you got malaria early on during your work studying chimpanzees, and how come that didn't make you want to just give up and go home? I mean, you were really sick for a while. It's not like you had TV to watch or lots of great home cooked meals. It wasn't, sometimes when you get sick, it's like, well, great, an enforced vacation from work. But, I don't think that would have been the way you experienced it in the forest. So was it hard to just stick it through during the illness?
No, not a bit. I mean, the illness is horrible. I mean, it was, I think, especially bad for my mother. We both had it and she really was very, very sick. You don't feel it's an enforced holiday because you are really, really sick with terrible headaches and fevers and chills and, it's beastly. But I just couldn't wait to get better. I mean, that was what I wanted. I wanted to get better, to get on with this exciting opportunity. I never felt like giving up. I did desperately worry that the funds would run out before I'd found something really exciting. And then I knew Lewis wouldn't be able to get more money. So that was the biggest worry.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did find something exciting. A lot of scientists have seen humans as the only animal that uses tools. And you basically saw a chimp working with a tool. What was the tool?
Yeah, that's right. And not only using it as a tool, but actually making tools, which was the real breakthrough. It was a piece of grass, and it was being used by a chimpanzee whom I'd named David Greybeard, who was the first to lose his fear of me. And when I saw him squatting on this termite mound and using this piece of grass as a tool and then picking a leafy twig and stripping the leaves off, thus making the object suitable to fish for termites, I mean, I actually was so excited I couldn't believe it. And I wouldn't let myself get too worked up until I'd actually seen it again on another day because it seemed so unlikely and I didn't have a very clear view. I was sort of hidden in the vegetation. But anyway,
real. Describe a little bit more how he was using this grass as a tool.
Well, the termites make a mound. There are a lot of different kinds of termites, and these make large, very, very hard earth compacted by their own saliva, and they're reddish-coloured. And at a certain time of year, the winged termites fly out, and the worker termites make passages up to the surface of these nests, these very hard nests. And so David would pick a piece of grass, carefully push it into one of these tunnels, wait for a moment, pull it out very, very carefully, and there would usually be termites biting on, and he would then pick them off with his lips and crunch them up.
So when you described this to Lewis Leakey, what was his reaction?
Now we must redefine man, redefine tool, or accept chimpanzees as humans.
And so which did you end up doing? Redefining tool, man, or accept chimps as human?
I think, I didn't really pay any attention to that. I didn't do anything. I think what's fascinating is every time somebody discovers an animal doing something that we used to think was unique to us, there is this scientific uproar. Because we have to keep our uniqueness. And, of course, the chimps have challenged this belief again and again and again. There are all kinds of intellectual performances we used to think unique to us, abstraction, generalization, understanding and using abstract symbols, things like this that they've been shown to do, especially some of the careful work in captive situations. And because of this and because of all the similarities in emotion, happiness, sadness, fear, because of the fact they have such very vivid personalities. They've really helped so much to blur the line that used to be perceived as sharp, dividing humans on the one hand from the rest of the animal kingdom on the other. And it sort of gives you a new humility. We're different, yes. We're unique, yes. But not as different as we used to think.
Jane Goodall will be back in the second half of the show. Her new book is called Reason for Hope, A Spiritual Journey. A companion documentary will be shown October 27th on public TV. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jane Goodall. Her new book, Reason for Hope, A Spiritual Journey, is about her life in the wild, researching chimpanzees in Tanzania's Gombe Reserve. You raised a child during your research in the forest in Tanzania. Was your approach to mothering affected by watching chimps mother their babies?
Well, I think it was. I mean, I consciously thought that what I'd learned from watching the chimpanzee mothers was very appropriate for raising a human child. I think one of the things that I've learned that's really significant in relation to raising human children is that there are very different kinds of mothering in the wild. We find good mothers and bad mothers. And the good mother will be attentive, protective, tolerant, playful, affectionate, and above all, supportive. And the mother who is on the poorer end of the scale tends to be rather harsh or cold in her treatment of the baby, to be less supportive, less affectionate, less tolerant, and much less playful. And it does seem that these maternal characteristics, along with the kind of family into which the infant is born, in other words, the whole early experience, has a tremendous influence on the type of chimpanzee that infant will become. And we find that those with the good supportive mothers tend to be assertive, successful, they have relaxed relationships with other adults, whereas those that have the colder, less supportive mothers tend to grow up being rather nervous, finding it difficult to relate well to other adults, and usually being rather low-ranking on the dominant scale. So if this early experience is so important for chimps, is it perhaps also for humans? And I believe that it is, and I think there's a growing body of scientific data to suggest that that's so.
So did you try to be extra supportive, tolerant, and playful with your child?
Yeah, and I also spent, you know, for the first 3 years, I basically was with him all the time. And people have said, oh, well, you were so lucky you could do your research and stay with your child. But in fact, because I made this conscious decision to spend time with him because I felt it was important, that meant that I actually stopped following the chimps. I just occasionally walked up to look at them, but then I'd go back and spend time with my son. And the funny thing is that even if I hadn't observed the chimps, I probably would have brought my son up in much the same way because my mother treated us very much like the old female Flo treated her young. So I don't know.
So did you have researchers who were observing the chimps during those years when you were spending most of your time with your child?
Oh, yeah. By that time, we'd built up the research station, which, of course, is still very dynamic and alive today. So we're actually approaching our 40th year of research. It's the longest unbroken study of any group of wild animals in the world. And the wonderful thing is we have one chimpanzee, Fifi, Flo's daughter, who was a small infant when I began in 1960. And she's the only one still alive today from those early years. But, you know, I can go back to Gombe, look into her eyes, and I know that there are certain memories that she and I share from those early years.
What's her status now in the larger group of chimpanzees?
She is very high ranking. She's the top ranked female. She's had an extraordinarily successful reproductive career. She's had 8 infants altogether, and only one has died so far, whereas most females fail to raise more than 2 young to full reproductive maturity. Fifi has 4 fully adult offspring. She has had 3 grandchildren. And both her sons, her eldest sons, have been top-ranked male, Freud and Frodo.
Are elders within the chimp population usually respected by the younger chimps?
Not as much as one would like. There is a certain respect, but at the same time, the old ones can be kind of hit around by highly roused adult males and tend to become a bit peripheral to the group and keep away as they get older. I mean, as they reach the age of sort of 48, 49, 50.
I want to get back to being a mother in the wild. Did you have to protect your baby from the chimps?
Oh, absolutely. Chimps are meat eaters, and they have been known to take human infants for food, including at Gombe. Well, at least in that part of, it was before it became a park, actually. And so it was very, very important to keep Grub, as we called him, away from the chimps and to always have someone with him. And that was why, while he was sort of two and three, I actually spent much, much less time at Gombe and more time with Hugo, my ex-husband, on the Serengeti, which was a sort of healthier and safer environment for a small toddling child.
It must have changed your feelings about the chimps too, knowing that they were a potential enemy.
It was very disturbing to think that these wonderful chimpanzees might harm my baby, my precious baby, because up until that time, I had thought that although chimps were very like us in so many ways, that they were rather nicer. And it was even more shocking to find, and this was when my son was already about 5 years old, to find that they were capable of extreme brutality, of cannibalism, and of a behavior that's very similar to primitive human warfare.
My guest is Jane Goodall. Her new book is called Reason for Hope. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jane Goodall, the world-renowned researcher of chimpanzees in the wild. Her new book is called Reason for Hope, A Spiritual Journey. Some of your most important findings from your research of chimps in the wild has to do with chimpanzee violence and how some chimpanzees may attack chimps of neighboring communities. Could you talk a little bit about what you found were possible motivations for these attacks?
We believe that the really serious attacks on members of a neighboring community are due to a sort of territorial dispute. We find that they're very aggressively territorial and that groups of males will patrol the boundaries of their territory. And they appear to be searching for sight or sound of neighbors. And that the males of a community, any number from 4 to 10, depending on the size of the community at the time, will actually enlarge their territory at the expense of a weaker neighbor. So it's not only protecting their territory for their females and young, but an active sort of acts of warfare almost to increase their own territory.
Yeah, you compare some of this hostile chimp behavior to primitive warfare. In what way are they similar?
We had one period at Gombe, which was, I think, the darkest period in Gombe's history, which we refer to as the Four-Year War. And it happened after the main study group had divided. And there was a period when there was a sort of no man's land between the two communities, newly established rangers. And then the males of the larger community, the Kasakela community, began going on raids into the heart of the land that had been taken over by the splinter group that moved off to the south. And if they encountered an individual on his or her own, they would give chase. It was like almost like a hunt. And once they captured such an individual, they would subject him or her to a really, really brutal and sustained attack. Nothing like that happens within a community. This is very special to inter-community interactions. And the chimps, particularly the young males, appear to enjoy this kind of conflict. And a young male will actually go back into a danger zone and peer at the enemies. So They also show patterns when they attack strangers that they never show during intra-community fighting, that's fighting within their community, such as twisting a limb round and round, drinking blood, tearing the skin, the sort of thing you see when they're trying to kill an adult prey animal.
Hmm. Has your research led you to make any connections between chimp and human violence?
Yes. It suggests if we believe in Darwinian evolution, if we believe, as Lewis did, and I do, that at one time we shared a common ancestor, then it seems fairly clear that we have inherited certain violent tendencies from our ancient primate ancestors. But I've been criticized for publishing some of these violent episodes because there are scientists who have argued that if I publish them, then there will be those who try to make use of those observations to imply that we are a violent species and war is inevitable. And I believe that we have quite a strong free will and that we are able to choose the direction we go. We don't have to go around being violent. And in fact, most people don't. Most people are quite disciplined. And we have to also remember that equally deeply rooted in our primate heritage are compassion, love, and altruism, because we find wonderful examples of these qualities in the chimps that we've studied.
Well, during your years in Africa, you've also had a chance to observe human aggression. There have been periods of civil war and ethnic fighting throughout a good deal of Africa. I'm wondering if the genocide in Rwanda had any effect on the area in Tanzania where your research is based.
It was actually the fighting in Burundi that had the biggest influence, mm-hmm. because that is just north of our border. I mean, it's only 22 miles from Gombe to the Burundi border. We had refugees flooding in from up the lake, from up north. And this had a very serious consequence. Already, the human population outside the tiny 30-square-mile national park was in excess of what the land could easily support. And these are very poor people who can't afford to buy food from elsewhere. So they were already beginning to face difficulties in their daily lives. And then comes this great influx of refugees. And although many of them were taken to camps, there were periods of time when they were hiding in the hills and depleting further the limited resources of the local people. And, you know, this led to the very serious question, how can we protect this 30-square-mile paradise full of forests and chimpanzees and other wonderful animals when outside the national park the trees have gone and the people are beginning to face starvation? That was a question that seriously perturbed us.
Keep going. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
We decided, and when I say we, I'm talking about the Jane Goodall Institute, we decided that the only way we could address this problem was to begin working quite intensively with the local people around the park and along the lakeshore. And so we started a project which is funded by the European Union, in part anyway, which has established tree nurseries in 27 of these small, very poor villages. And the villages, first of all, grow things that will be immediately beneficial, like fruit and vegetables and fast-growing timber for firewood and building poles and so forth. And then they start growing some of the indigenous trees. And conservation education methods are introduced into the villages for adults and for youth, soil erosion control and prevention, working with groups of women trying to improve their skills and their education, primary health care so that babies that are born will live, which will enable women for the first time to actually plan their families so that they can have smaller families, which is what they all want now. And finally, we've just begun microcredit lending tiny amounts of capital to groups of women so that they can initiate environmentally sustainable programs in their villages. And it's working because now they're turning around and realizing that they need to help us to save the chimps.
During the period when refugees from Burundi were crossing the border and coming into the area that the Jane Goodall Institute is based in, did the Institute become something of a refugee camp? Did you try to help to shelter some of the people who were homeless?
No, most of them actually were outside the park. Those that came in were rather rapidly gathered up by the big refugee agencies. So they were seldom more than a day on the shores of the lake. The biggest problem was the refugees who began coming over from eastern Zaire, that's now the Democratic Republic of Congo. And they were trying to hide in the hills around Gombe. They traditionally eat baboons and chimps and any kind of monkeys, which our local people do not. And we began to find baboons, but also one chimpanzee caught in snares. And this was dreadful. This was just 2 years ago.
Was there anything you tried to do to stop that?
The national park staff began doing more patrols, and we had to actually dart the three baboons and one chimp to remove the snares. In the case of the chimp, her hand was so badly gangrened that her hand had to be amputated.
So there's this, 30-square-mile park that, you know, animals can live in a protected way and wildlife can grow in a protected way. Are there people who, are there Africans now who are challenging the sanctity of that park and saying it should be opened up to people?
They were until we started working with them. But once we introduced this program, and now working with UNICEF, we hope to introduce hygienic latrines and fresh water to as many as 33 villages in the area. So we're actually very popular, and they want to help us.
Did you ever expect that your work would branch out into this area?
Certainly not when I began, but, you know, my life really changed when I went to a conference in Chicago, which was for the first time bringing all the chimpanzee people under one roof, all those not doing invasive research, a session on conservation, seeing what was going on across Africa. And I realized, you know, they're going fast, and I have to do what I can to try and help conservation efforts. And a session on the use of chimps in medical research, which sickened me, actually. And I realized I had to stop living selfishly in my own little paradise and use the knowledge I'd gained to do what I could to help.
Jane Goodall, we have time for one last question. I know you lecture on the road in support of the Jane Goodall Institute about 300 days a year. And you say it's sometimes very embarrassing because you're very bad on facial recognition. You just can't remember faces. But I'm wondering, you know, most people can't differentiate between one chimp and another because they're not experienced in it. How do you manage to remember which chimp is which, yet have no memory for human faces?
Well, it isn't that I have no memory for human faces. It turns out to be a neurological complaint, which is much more common than I had thought. I mean, I never told anyone for ages. I was so embarrassed. And it's the same with the chimps. But fortunately for me, I don't have this, whatever you want to call it, disease or condition as badly as some people. So as soon as I get to really know someone, I always remember them again. And it's the same with the chimps. But I have more trouble identifying them quickly than many other people do for the same reason.
Do you try, when you're working in the wild, to look for distinguishing characteristics in the chimps that can help you remember which is which or determine which is which?
Yeah, I do, and I do with people as well. I mean, you know, it is embarrassing because I really love people, and as soon as I click in, I know exactly who they are and what they mean to me and what they said the day before. It's just this rather funny block, which I was told all about it by Oliver Sacks, you know, the great neurologist.
Yeah.
He has this condition so badly that he doesn't recognize his secretary after 10 years.
Wow.
Well, I don't have anything like that bad. I mean, I certainly know all my friends instantly.
Just one more thing. We only have a few seconds. You say that, you know, you really do love people. Do a lot of people assume that since you've spent so much time in the wild, often alone, studying chimps, that maybe you're antisocial?
Some people do feel that, and they say, which do I like best, chimps or people? And I say, well, chimps are so like us that I like some people much more than some chimps, and some chimps much more than some people.
Great answer. Jane Goodall, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jane Goodall's new book is called Reason for Hope, A Spiritual Journey. A companion documentary will be shown October 27th on public TV. This is Fresh Air.